Michael Goldberg's new book, Wicked Game, The True Story of Guitarist James Calvin Wilsey, goes deep into the life of a brilliant but doomed unsung genius who we lost too soon. Jimmy wasn't just a great and unique guitarist, but a music pioneer. Michael met Jimmy Wilsey in 1982 at a Silvertone gig, and a few years later interviewed him in 1987. Not long after that, they became friends. His book tells the story of a charming, incredibly talented guy who ultimately succumbed to the dark side of addiction. It's riveting, funny at times, heartbreaking and tragic, but fascinating, and hard to put down. You're listening to Frets with DJ Faye. No lessons, no technique info. I just talk to people who play guitar. Stay tuned. Today I'm talking with Michael Goldberg, who has a new book out, Wicked Game, The True Story of Guitarist James Calvin Wilsey. Of course, I want to talk about the book and also your connection to and the time you spent with Jimmy, but for the listeners, Michael has had articles published in Cream, Downbeat, Esquire, Musician, New Musical Express, and then went on to become music editor and senior writer at Rolling Stone for 10 years. What got you interested in writing about musicians?
When I was, 12 years old, like a lot of people, I heard the Beatles, and that just got me, I couldn't get enough of them. And that quickly spread to the Rolling Stones and the Yardbirds and, oh God, Love, and just so many bands, the Who, all the San Francisco bands, Big Brother and the Holding Company, the Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Country Joe and the Fish. It was first the whole British invasion, then the whole San Francisco thing. And with San Francisco, I was here. I was in the Bay Area. So I was able to see all the bands live, even when I was really young.
Nice. Weren't you just in high school when you started a psychedelic poster business?
Well, yeah, I did that. And then what I also did was in junior high school. And basically, this friend of mine and I, back in 1967, when I was, a kid in junior high, in San Francisco, there were two ballrooms, and one of them was the Avalon Ballroom. And they had these great artists who made the posters. And they would put the posters up all over Sausalito, which was not that far from where I lived. So we'd go there every week and we'd get the posters. And so then we figured out, hey, if we started this poster business, that would mean we could go meet the people at the Avalon Ballroom.
Nice.
Who were doing this. And so that was kind of part of what motivated us to do it, just because we wanted to get into the scene, so to speak.
Right.
But then in high school, we actually, published one issue of a print rock magazine that I financed from money that I had saved for a bunch of years.
Yeah, I think that led you to even doing photography of some pretty big names.
Well, I started taking photographs when I was 13, and the first people I took pictures of were Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison of the Doors.
Wow.
And Ray Manzarek of the Doors, and pretty quick, Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead. That was when I was really young. I started taking pictures, and then I got better as time went on. And I ended up doing a lot of photographs. There's a lot of my photographs, or a fair amount of them, in this book, as well as obviously the text that I wrote.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned your time with Rolling Stone, which you were there quite a while. You wrote a lot of cover stories for Rolling Stone. And at one point, you did write an article. I don't remember if it was a cover story or just a feature on Chris Isaak. Was that before you met Jimmy Wilsey?
No. I met Jimmy in 1982 when I was, at that point, I was writing freelance stories to a number of places, mostly in the Bay Area at that point. And I came up with an idea to do a story on four kind of upcoming bands. And I did some research, and a lot of people were excited about Silvertone. And I heard some of their music, and they were great. And so I went to this club in Berkeley called the Berkeley Square and saw their set, and they were tremendous. And Jimmy and Chris were actually, they were actually harmonizing, or Jimmy was sort of harmonizing on some of the songs. And they did like an Everly Brothers song. And it was just, they were great. I mean, the whole, everything about this band was great. So I met, after they finished their set, Eric Jacobson was kind of out in the audience. He, you know, he had produced The Love and Spoonful, and who I had been a big fan of. And so anyway, I talked to Eric a bit. And then he took me backstage. And so that's when I met Jimmy and Chris and John Silvers, who was in the band at that time, and a bass player named Jamie. So it was 82 is when I first met Jimmy. And then I did a bunch of stories about, basically, it, they went for, stopped being Silvertone. Well, it actually became Chris Isaak and Silvertone. Mm-hmm. And so I did a bunch of stories about Chris Isaak and interviewed Jimmy for some of those stories. And so we, you know, we got to know each other in the 80s. And then by the beginning of the 90s is when we actually became friends, to the point where I, you know, I'd go over to his place fairly often. And I also did a profile of Jimmy for Guitar Player after Wicked Game became a big hit.
Yeah, I used to buy Guitar Player. I didn't have a subscription, but I would just buy it here and there. The local whatever store was selling it on the stands or whatever, but I lost contact. I mean, you and I talked a while back, and I shared a few stories about, you know, knowing Jimmy in high school. Yeah, he like sat right behind me in civics or social studies or whatever they called it then. You know, even though he was fairly quiet, it definitely wasn't anything to do with being shy, or at least I don't think so. He always had this sort of half smile, smirk, like there was, you know, some inside joke that you maybe weren't in on. And, you know, girls thought he was really cute. All the guys thought he was really cool. And like I said, we weren't like close friends. We just knew each other from class, and everyone who played guitar seemed to know who else played. And so my friend Stan and I were attempting to have a band, just kind of practicing here and there in the basement of his parents' house. We both knew Jimmy and asked him to bring his guitar over two or three times. We needed a bass guitar player and asked if he could play bass notes on his guitar. So as usually, he always just has very nice, you know, laid back demeanor, but the sessions really didn't produce much. And he kind of politely declined and said he wasn't really interested. And so, yeah. And then beyond that, I mean, before you know it, we're all graduating from high school. I didn't hear anything about him for years until, of course, I spotted his name on the first few albums by Chris Isaak in the liner notes. You know, even then it took a bit to sink in. Because I was seeing, you know, James Calvin Wilsey listed, and then it was like, oh, wait, I kind of eventually put two and two together. But
he never really was that excited about playing bass. So I'm not surprised that he wasn't into it, you know, with the band that you and your friend were putting together. Because, I mean, he wanted to play guitar in the Avengers. I mean, that's what he originally talked to. He asked Penelope Houston, who, you know, was the singer in the Avengers, if they could use another guitar player. She said, no, but do you play bass? Because they were not happy with Jonathan Postel, who was their bass player.
Yeah,
who'd been in the band, and the band had only been together for about maybe a month. And so Jimmy just went for it. And then I think he really dug being in the Avengers. I mean, I know he did. You know, eventually, you know, he wanted to play guitar.
Right. So he agreed to play bass for them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Which always kind of cracks me up.
I think
he was better off. I don't think we would have gone anywhere. But anyway.
I mean, they were playing the Mabue Gardens, which was, you know, the punk club in San Francisco. So, I mean, he'd seen them. He thought they were a great band. And he knew he was going to be in front of a lot of people instantly, you know. If he joined the Avengers.
Right.
So there were lots of different reasons why he went for playing bass in that band.
We are the leaders of tomorrow. We are the ones who have the fight. Looking to buy a guitar, an amp, pedals? Find great deals on all of these, as well as audio and recording gear, at Reverb.com. You can also sell your gear through Reverb. They have great articles about music gear and bands. And Reverb believes music makes the world a better place. That's why they created Reverb Gives, that provides youth music education programs all over the world with the instruments they need to make music. Link to Reverb through Frets with DJ Faye in the show notes for this episode.
I mean, it's fascinating to look at, you know, photographs from that era and just the, such a different, you know, just all the kind of phases and changes he went through. But yeah, then so eventually, yeah, he's with Chris Isaak and Silvertone, and he left after just the first few albums. I think it was around like 1995, maybe.
He was basically fired.
Okay, yeah. I wondered, one of my questions was, did he leave? I've seen mixed things, but I was like, he was asked to leave.
Well, this is sort of jumping into the thick of it, but, you know, he became a heroin addict.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He basically, what happened was Wicked Game happened. And suddenly, I mean, they were, you know, that song was in the top 10 in not just the U.S., but in 9 other countries, in addition to the U.S. So they were touring. I mean, it was the whole rock star thing. And he met this actress, and she became his girlfriend. And so for part of 90, that was actually right before Wicked Game, you know, became a hit. They got together. And then, so for the next year or so, he had this movie star girlfriend. And then she broke up with him. And that was coinciding also with the fact that he didn't get any publishing. He didn't have a writing credit on Wicked Game, even though he wrote the introduction and all the guitar parts for that song. He didn't have a writing credit on it. He was getting a percentage of the record sales, and then, you know, record to and CD sales and cassette sales, but he wasn't getting any publishing. And that makes a big difference in how much money you're getting. And he was also not getting a huge percentage in terms of his record royalties. So that was just another thing. He was bitter about the whole situation. And so he'd hung in there for all these years. But then when they finally have the hit, it was like, I think he thought when the hit happened, everything was going to change. And everything didn't change in terms of how he felt. You know, his girlfriend breaks up with him, and he had already been using heroin prior to that. And so that just sent all of that stuff just sent him into real, you know, a real heavy duty addiction situation. And so he was showing up at rehearsals and stuff, and he couldn't remember his parts. And he was just, yeah, it was just messed up.
Wow.
So finally, so anyway, Eric Jacobson, who was the manager producer, and Isaac, they couldn't keep going with him. So at that point, he was let go, but it was never public, sort of what happened. He would tell people that he was leaving, that he left the band. That's what he would tell people. That's what he told me at that time and told other people.
Right.
And he was really upset about the whole situation. So it's very possible that I think he was, because even when he was still in the band, he was telling me that he was going to leave. And so it may have been a situation where he was thinking about leaving, and then Isaac fired him.
Wow. Well, backing up to, you know, those first few albums, I mean, it was kind of crazy how it seems like just in a matter of a few years, I mean, even from my perspective, there was a good friend of mine and I who really got into, you know, the first 3 or 4 albums. Well, actually, even the first couple albums, we were listening to him, but it was like we didn't know a whole lot of other people who were really – Chris Isaak wasn't as huge at all in the, you know, when we first started listening to those first couple albums. And then – yeah, somewhere along the line, it was actually Stan, the guy I mentioned, you know, that we tried to have this band in junior high. He and I were talking and said, you know what Wilsey's doing, right? And he's the one that told me that he was playing with Chris Isaak. Anyway, we just loved those early albums are just so great. And then, yeah, of course, getting back to Wicked Game, yeah, I mean, everyone, including me, thought, wow, what a huge breakthrough. I mean, what a beautiful, haunting song. And I mean, Odin large part to that beautiful guitar work. And
Yeah,
well, I think we all thought too, like, wow, this is really taken off. And you know, little did we know that he was really struggling, and he's really personally, he was struggling.
Yeah, I mean, the thing was that, yeah, those three albums, I mean, the first album is an incredible, I think it's just a perfect record.
It's so great. I mean, yeah.
And his playing, and the thing was, Jimmy basically was responsible for the sound of Chris Isaak. It was his guitar that really set the whole mood for those songs. And before, even though they weren't that popular in the U.S. until Wicked Game happened, I mean, they were playing like a 300 capacity club in San Rafael, California, you know, which is just across from San Francisco. They had that booked prior to Wicked Game being a hit. And so Wicked Game is like in the top 40, and they were doing a gig at a 300 capacity club.
Wow.
But they did have success in France earlier on. And like the song Blue Hotel off the second album, which actually was a song that they were playing back. They were playing that the night I saw them in 82. I mean, that was an early song, but it only appeared on the second album. And that song was a hit in France, I guess around 86 or 87.
Well, I mean, even before Wicked Game, David Lynch certainly heard something. He used, you know, on Blue Velvet, he used the music in a couple scenes, and it was some great stuff.
Definitely.
Yeah, it was just interesting, like I said, to watch this sort of progression of, wow, it was very cool to me that, like, wow, that's Jimmy. And then seeing the band just get bigger and bigger. And I don't know, it's just such a sad thing that I would have never known that he was really, really on a personal level, just having all these problems.
Yeah. I mean, he was using drugs and alcohol to kind of escape, even going back to his high school days. Him and another friend would, this other friend would come over to his place. This was in high school, before school, and they'd drink gin fizzes. Like his mom would be gone. She was working at a hospital. His dad was working somewhere. And so they'd be drinking gin fizzes before they went to school. And, I mean, during that time he was, you know, that was sort of the beginning in terms of drugs and alcohol. The thing is, he was later diagnosed as depressed. And the psychiatrist who did the diagnosis said that it probably had started when he was a kid. So, you know, this started really early on. He didn't know that he had clinical depression until later. But in fact, he did. You know, his family moved around a fair amount when he was really young, and that can lead to drug and alcohol abuse later.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, and then also the thing of growing up in a family with a military father can be really difficult on kids as well. So there were a lot of different things that I think contributed to that part of his life.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back. That's Eric Roscoe Amble from his classic album, Roscoe's Gang, produced by Eric, along with Lou Whitney, and featuring Ron Rongo Gremp, Joe Terry, and D. Clinton Thompson, all former members of the Morels. I hope you'll listen to my two-part interview with Roscoe in season one of Frets with DJ Faye.
You know, that was the hottest gig in town, the Morels gig, and there was a sign, and Rongo was at the door, you know, and there was a sign that said, Donnie's sick, the Morels can't play tonight, but Lou has sent the Del Lords from New York City. And really, like, for our band, that made St. Louis became a second home almost for us, you know, throughout the band's existence.
Eric Roscoe Amble from season one of Frets.
Hey, this is Michael Goldberg, and you're listening to Frets with DJ Faye.
Well, I obviously did still listen to, and I actually did see Chris Isaak post-Jimmy. Saw him, really only saw him one time when Jimmy was still with the band. My brother lives in LA, and my brother and I went to see at the Universal Amphitheater. We saw a show where Jimmy was still with the band. But yeah, my wife really loves Chris Isaak. I do too. We enjoyed seeing him in concert, but it just wasn't, the albums weren't quite the same, and the experience wasn't quite the same. I don't know. There was definitely a different mood or sound, noticeable to me anyway.
Well, yeah. I mean, because Jimmy was an innovator.
Yeah.
You know, now they have a guitar player who's, you know, he's a good guitar player, but he's not an innovator. He's nowhere like Jimmy. Jimmy was a real creative spirit. This was a guy who would just come up with stuff. I mean, that's two notes, you know, the beginning of Wicked Game. Mm-hmm.
Played beautifully.
How brilliantly, I mean, it's played beautifully. I mean, everything about it is incredible. All people have to do is hear those two notes. And it's like all over the world. That song, 30 plus years after, you know, it was a hit, is being listened to millions of times on Spotify.
Sure.
Yeah. Every month. In just the 3 years that I worked on this book, that song was streamed 200 million times.
Wow.
That song has been streamed more times on Spotify than any song by Janis Joplin or the Jefferson Airplane or Huey Lewis and the News or Santana. I mean, it's one of the most popular songs to ever come out of the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah. Well, I've come across videos of Jimmy playing with the band The Mysteries. He was in for a stretch, maybe, I don't know, around 2000 or whatever. And, of course, it's interesting to watch. I have to say, he was already starting to look much different at that point. And, yeah, you just kind of see sort of a steady decline. I mean, would you agree? I mean, you saw him a lot more.
Well, by the time he moved to L.A., he had a very serious drug problem. Mm-hmm. And he had tried multiple times to stop. And after he got to L.A., he was able to stop for a while. He had this one girlfriend. He went to her place in L.A. and she helped him clean up. But then he went back to it. And that was kind of basically the pattern for the rest of his life. And even by then, when the Mysteries thing happened, I think there may have been a brief period in there when he wasn't using, but by 2000, he was using again. Mm. And he broke that band up. And then later he recorded, you know, his solo album, El Dorado. Then he put a band together. And that band played for, I don't know, 6 to 9 months. He called that the Jimmy Wilsey Orchestra sometimes, and Jimmy Wilson and his orchestra sometimes. But by not too far into that album came out at the beginning of 2008. And just a few months later, he just vanished. I mean, it was like he didn't even tell the guys in the band that he was going to stop playing. It was like suddenly they're just not hearing from him. They're not getting calls. He's not answering their calls. He's not answering their emails or their, you know, none of it. And they didn't, you know, it was like, what the hell's going on here? But he was, you know, he was messed up again.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because around that time or prior to that album coming out, you know, I was connecting on social media and Facebook to some people I hadn't seen in years. And he was on there and he and I, you know, we never had any phone conversations, but we were connected on Facebook and we would occasionally send like a messenger message to each other and just laughing about this, that, or the other. And he seemed, I don't know, seemed in good spirits, or at least, you know, we both had a pretty warped sense of humor and, you know, we would like comment and on each other's posts or like them or whatever. But yeah, then El Dorado comes out and I loved it when it came out. I still love it. I not only loved it, but I was like very hopeful that maybe he'd continue to keep putting out more albums or maybe start doing film scores or something. I don't know. It just seemed like, wow, that's such a great album. And it just sounds like this wonderful soundtrack to like a, it, to me, I keep coming back to David Lynch, but it almost sounds like a soundtrack to a David Lynch film or like a beautiful Western film. But yeah, getting back to your point, that album comes out. Shortly after, yeah, occasionally I would see a video, maybe like a live performance of a song off El Dorado, and then he just kind of vanished. I didn't see him saying anything or posting anything on social media. He just sort of, and there was nothing beyond El Dorado. And then,
well, I think he may have been, you know, I mean, first of all, the album came out on a company that is really in the movie business. And their idea was that they wanted to use those songs in some of their films. And they did do that. They did use the various instrumentals in different films. But they, you know, right from the start, I mean, when he did a deal with them, they weren't, there wasn't going to be any tour support. There wasn't going to be any, you know, radio marketing or any of that. And he knew that up front. And I don't know what he actually had in his head. One of his friends thinks that he, his expectations for what was going to happen were bigger than what actually happened. You know, it's an instrumental album from a guy who at that point hadn't done anything in a, you know, a long, long time.
Yeah.
And so, and it wasn't like even when Wicked Game was happening, I mean, focus was all on Chris Isaak, even though here Jimmy was so instrumental, but you know, Chris Isaak's the front guy. He's the charming, you know, singer and entertainer. But by then, by the time El Dorado came out, just a long time had passed. And they did, when they were playing LA, which is where Jimmy lived, the drummer told me that at one of the gigs, four people showed up. So I think some of this was pretty, had to be, that, you know, quite depressing for Jimmy.
Sure.
Another thing was that it seems like when things would go really good for Jimmy, that was a time when he would kind of shoot himself in the foot. So here he finally gets his album out and, you know, he's back, I mean, using heroin and getting messed up, and to the point where he breaks up, you know, he just vanishes. And that's another thing that happens with people addicted to drugs is they vanish.
Yeah.
They just disappear. I mean, they don't, and it's for different reasons, but that's a common thing. It's not unusual.
Yeah.
But it was so sad because he makes this beautiful album and he makes it. I mean, Jimmy from really early on was a computer wizard, and he did consulting for Apple computers in the late 80s. He was one of the first people who was using this program called DEC, which was a four-track software program that where you could record on a Macintosh.
Right.
And that program was used, they used that for in part for Wicked Game, for some of the stuff that ended up on that in terms of his guitar. And so, I mean, Jimmy, he was an expert on this stuff. And so by the time he made El Dorado, which he recorded in, I think like 2006, 2007, by the time that happened, he did that whole thing in his dining room on his computer. And a fair amount of the guitar playing, he said, was done. He had his guitar just plugged right into the computer.
Yeah.
And it was going through a software program that creates, you know, basically imitates amp sounds.
Exactly.
And so it's pretty amazing. I mean, and he did it, and it's great. And that to have done such a beautiful piece of work and then to just fall apart again, I mean, it's so, so sad.
I like coffee, and I admit, I've become a bit of a coffee snob. I drink coffee black because, hey, if you want to load up a cup with cream and sugar and syrups and all that, well, whatever. I want my coffee to be delicious without adding anything to it. I take the time to do pour-overs at home. I grind the beans and use my Chemex. The process is worth the wait, and when I buy beans, I buy coffee from my buddy String Bean Pete, coffee roaster and owner of String Bean Coffee. Pete's goal is to offer the finest beans from around the world. He roasts them passionately in small batches in non-computerized old-school ways to music under a disco ball. Yeah, you heard that right. He's a bit of a kook, but that's why I like him.
And I really, really, really like String Bean Coffee. Find out more at stringbeancoffee.com.
I mean, another thing that happened a few years later in 2013, he got contacted by someone who worked for Lana Del Rey, and she wanted him on her album.
Oh, wow.
And she had a song called Black Beauty, and she gave it to Jimmy, and he recorded guitar parts for that song that are just beautiful. But she decided to take the song in another direction and didn't use Jimmy's split stuff. And I think that was another thing that just really hurt him. Yeah. I mean, I think he thought that this was going to be another opportunity for him for a comeback. And of course, if he had been on a Lana Del Rey album that had, you know, which in fact the album, which one it was, I think it's like her second album. I don't have the title right in front of me here, but if he'd been on that album, that was a big success, that album.
Yeah.
And who knows how he would have reacted to that, but, you know, but it didn't happen. She didn't use it. He wasn't on it. And,
So sad.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's just really too bad. And it's just like Jimmy's story. It's his personal story, but I mean, as a sideman in a band, this stuff happens to a lot of people. It's, you know, it in terms of the songwriting stuff, in terms of the drugs, in terms of not getting the credit.
Yeah, that's a big one.
You know, because it's like the guy, and you see it, you know, where people, singers leave the band and they go solo.
Right.
And they never do anything as good as what they did in their band, but they still do. That's what they do. And then it leaves, a lot of times just leaves the other guys, because they, even though they're really good, they need that charismatic front person.
Yeah. Well, I found out about Jimmy dying when a friend of mine who knew he was in punk bands and he was well aware of the Avengers. And he knew all about Jimmy. Yeah, I don't think he knew him personally, but he knew about Jimmy and he knew I knew him. He sent me a link to your Rolling Stone story on Jimmy, the King of Slow, that announced his death. And it was a beautiful article, but it was just a real punch in the gut. I mean, it just made me so sad and, you know, just shocked to see that news. And boy, I just remember the day that I I received that link and opened that article. It was just really just such a sad, sad moment.
Yeah. I mean, I was on Facebook and there was a post by the photographer Chester Simpson, a longtime friend of mine. And he had done a post based on a post that Penelope Houston of the Avengers had put up. And basically, you know, what it said was that Jimmy had died on Christmas Eve day. And I was shocked. I mean, I just about fell over. I couldn't believe it, because, I mean, one, Jimmy was only 61.
Right.
You know, but the other thing was, I had been out of touch with Jimmy for a bunch of years, but I was doing a story about sort of the lasting impact of the Mabuhay Gardens, the San Francisco punk club. And so I thought, well, it'd be really interesting to see what Jimmy has to say about the Mabuhay and playing there and all that. So I had messaged him back in June and he didn't respond. And I was like, wow, that's really weird. I wonder what's going on. And then about a month later, he did respond, but it was just a thumbs up emoji. And I'm like, in my message, I was asking him if we could get on the phone for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes to get some quotes for this story. And I'm just thinking, why is he doing that? Why a thumbs up emoji and not, hey, give me a call. Here's my phone number,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I said, hey, the article's done, but if I think there's still time to fit a quote from you in, you know, let's get on the phone here. And another bunch of time goes by. And then in September, in like, I think it's early September, he sends me this short message, you know, lost my phone, or, you know, haven't had a phone, you know, some sort of excuse, when I, you know, as soon as I do, I'll get in touch with you. And then that was the last I ever heard from him. I mean, the next thing I knew about Jimmy after that was reading that he had died. And it's just like, wow, you know, 6 months, you know, actually at that point it was just a few months because it had been September. So, you know, we're talking December. And I was just like, I just couldn't believe it. And then the thing was, Jimmy's died. This is horrible. At least there should be an obituary on Jimmy in like the San Francisco Chronicle, because, you know, here he was in two important San Francisco groups.
Right.
Nothing. Week goes by, 2 weeks go by. Los Angeles Times. Here he lived in Los Angeles for 20 years. I mean, come on. Nothing there. Nothing in Billboard. Nothing anywhere except a couple of obscure things online that, you know, just brief mentions that Jimmy had died. So finally, after a couple of weeks went by, I got in touch with, editor that I stayed in touch with. You know, I left Rolling Stone at a certain point, but, you know, I stayed in touch with people. And so I got in touch with the managing editor there and said, hey, what about a piece on Jimmy Wilsey? I mean, this guy was important. And anyway, they decided that, yeah, he was important and he should get some coverage. And so even though they had missed the boat in terms of the timing for an obituary, they said, well, let's do a story, you know, do a feature story about him. And so I wrote the piece that you read. And, you know, but really, Rolling Stone was the only place where anything significant ran on Jimmy. Yeah. And so, you know, time was going by. I mean, well, then I did a much longer piece for a Australian publication that I write for. But then the thing was that I'm not seeing any other sort of significant media covering him. And I thought, well, Jimmy's story is an important story. One, he's an important guitar player that shouldn't be forgotten. And two, this whole story, what happened to him, is something I think people would really, really want to read about. And so, you know, I decided that I was gonna write a book about him, mostly because I didn't want him to be forgotten.
Right.
And then as I, you know, and then I spent, you know, like I said, I spent like, you know, 3+ years writing this thing, and talked to a lot of people who knew Jimmy. And some people I talked to many, many times over those years. I mean, like Eric Jacobson, you know, the producer manager, we must have had, I don't know, 80 conversations or something. I mean, a lot of phone calls, you know, I mean, hours and hours of conversation. And there were a lot of people like that where I keep talking to them over the course of, you know, a couple of years.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I try to find my personality and my identity in the music the best I can. And by the fact that I am such a blues advocate, I mean, you know, usually the interpretation turns out a little bit closer to the blues side, you know? But I just love the music, and I'm just so happy that, you know, people still can find some appreciation for what I do.
That's blues man Larry McRae. We had a great talk before he hit the road for his current tour. Coming soon on Frets, my interview with a really great guitarist, Larry McRae. Stay tuned.
Arkansas. Come up feeding hogs and baling straw.
I mean, I have to say I'm really proud of this book. I mean, it's a really sad story that it tells, but I think it really does justice to Jimmy in a couple of ways. I mean, one, it tells the real story. It doesn't hold back. But two, it also, I think I did a pretty good job of telling people who read it why he was important, what he did, you know, what was special about his playing. And the book really gets into the music pretty significantly. And I had interviewed Jimmy for, and during two interviews, I'd interviewed him for like 4 hours. And I also got access to the last interview he did. I'm pretty sure it's the last one, which is a 3-hour interview. And so I was able to, but in the 4 hours that I had of him talking to me, I mean, we talked a lot about music and he talked about specific songs and, you know, what he played on them, how he came to play such and such. Really interesting stories about like playing backwards guitar on the song Unhappiness on the first, Chris Isaak album and a bunch of other stuff. I mean, you know, and how he came up with the Wicked Game riff. And so people that really care about music and musicians, I think they're going to find some really great stuff in there. People who are just fans, well, they're going to find, you know, a lot of interesting stuff there. And even I think people who didn't even know who Jimmy was, I think would find this book pretty interesting because it really is kind of the story of the dark side of rock and roll.
Yeah, I think so too. I think, yeah, like you said, it's tragic, but it's fascinating. And I mean, I'm so glad. And I think it's great that you wrote about his life. I mean, it came to a tragic end, but it does document so much of what he was and what he was like as a person and how creative he was. So it's great to have this book.
He was a really incredible person in terms of, I mean, like when you knew him as a kid and, you know, and in high school and then later on, I mean, up through the early 90s, Jimmy was like such a, he was a really generous person for his friends. I mean, like I write about this in the book, but he gave my son guitar lessons.
I did read that.
and this was when, this was like after Wicked Game had happened. He had plenty of other things he could have been doing.
Sure.
But he was like, yeah, sure. Bring him over. You know, we can, yeah. You know, I'll give him some guitar lessons.
That's so great.
And, you know, it was just, and Penelope Houston told me that, you know, the Avengers are over. She'd gone and done some other stuff. She's back in San Francisco and she writes one of her first post-Avengers songs. And Jimmy comes over and he helps her record a demo of that song. And just as a favor, just because she was a friend, you know, again, he had other stuff he could have been doing. And that's kind of, that's how he was. I mean, later in life, I mean, the drugs kind of messed him up and drugs do bad things to you in terms of your personality.
Yeah, they really do.
I mean, it's, you know, but for a big portion of life, of his life, he was a really, really generous, you know, cool guy.
Yeah. And that's the way I want to remember him.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, my mom still lives in Florissant, Missouri, where I went to school with Jimmy. And I passed like right by the high school that, you know, we went to on the way to her house. I don't even, does he still have some family in that area?
No, I think everyone is, no, because, you know, his parents are gone.
That's what I thought.
And,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know about, you know, if there's some distant relatives that I don't know. But basically, I mean, he's got, at this point, his sisters are in Arizona. Hmm. And their kids, I think, are in Arizona. And, you know, his brother passed away, who lived in L.A. for you know, until he died, Don. For people who want to buy the book, the best place to get it is from the company that is publishing it, which is called Hozak. HOZAC Records and Books. They'll be selling it off their website. And the reason that's the best place to get it is because I'm donating 25% of anything, any royalties I get to Jimmy's teenage son, Waylon.
Oh, that's great.
And Waylon, you know, he doesn't have a father and his mother is alive, but he basically doesn't have a mother at this point. I mean, she's off elsewhere. And so he just turned 18 back in December. But before that, basically, one of his relatives was his guardian. So I'm going to donate that money to him. And he makes a lot more money when the book sells off of the website for Hozak Books and Records, or Records and Books, than if eventually, if, you know, if you were to get it off of Amazon.
Right, right.
And I also make more money. And the indie book company that's publishing also makes a lot more money. And that's all a good thing because they can publish more. They're into publishing books about, you know, cool people who aren't big stars necessarily.
Right.
So I just wanted to.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I even like with, you know, bands and artists, I often like to try to encourage people to, you know, even though they can, you know, stream it on Apple or Spotify or whatever, I usually sometimes encourage people to buy their stuff off Bandcamp or something, where more of the funds are going to the artist, and in this case, to a very, very good cause. I think that's great that you're doing that.
Well, I really wanted to do that. Was the idea from the beginning. I mean, as soon as I started working on the book, that's what I wanted to do, because, you know, I felt like Waylon's had a deal. It hasn't been easy, I know, for to be the son of, you know, someone who's messed up like that.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to at least be able to help him out a little bit.
You know? Sure. Well, Michael Goldberg, thanks for taking the time to do this.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Jimmy Wilsey is survived by his teenage son, Waylon James Wilsey. Wicked Game, the true story of guitarist James Calvin Wilsey, is a fascinating read. And if you purchase the book, please be sure to order from the publisher, Hozak Books. Michael Goldberg is donating a very generous portion to Waylon. A link is provided in this episode's show notes and on the Frets Facebook page. Hope you've enjoyed this special edition of Frets. Stay tuned.